The headlines this hour, 5 days of indiscriminate air raids in Gaza have claimed the lives of more than 1,000 Palestinians. Palestine's UN ambassador describes Israel's deadly campaign against Gaza as genocide, saying Israel's measures amount to war crimes. And more rallies are held worldwide in support of Palestinians and in condemnation of Israeli massacre of people in Gaza.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The Israeli regime continues its indiscriminate aerial strikes on the Gaza Strip for the fifth consecutive day, killing more people in the besieged Palestinian territory. At least 50 Palestinians have lost their lives in fresh Israeli attacks on Gaza, pushing the death toll to 1,050, including scores of children. The attacks have left more than 5,100 injured also. Israel has pounded Gaza's commercial zones, residential areas, and refugee camps. Gaza is under full Israeli siege, and now the only power plant there has shut down due to fuel outage. According to health authorities, overwhelmed hospitals without electricity will have to rely on their emergency generators, which will only last 2 to 4 days. Meanwhile, the Turkish president says that Israel is committing a massacre in the besieged strip.
Cutting off a city's water, electricity, entry and exits, collapsing its infrastructure, destroying all of its centers of worship from mosques to churches, as well as their schools, preventing people from getting the most fundamental needs, and bombing housing units where civilians reside. In other words, managing a conflict using every sort of embarrassing method is not a war, it is a massacre.
Erdogan says Israel is trying to portray bombing civilians as a proof of skills. The Turkish president's comments come as Israel is amassing troops and tanks near the Gaza fence, getting ready for a ground invasion. Israel has used internationally banned white phosphorus bombs in its strikes on Gaza's Karama neighborhood. Over 2 million Palestinians are trapped in the Gaza Strip, which is known as the world's biggest open-air prison. The regime launched its onslaught on Saturday after Gaza-based resistance groups carried out a multi-front operation in response to Israeli crimes. According to media, the operation has left 1,200 Israelis dead and nearly 3,000 others injured. Palestine's ambassador to the UN has lashed out at Israel for its deadly campaign against the Gaza Strip and the regime's decision to impose a complete siege on the territory.
Such blatant dehumanization and attempts to bomb people into submission, to use starvation as a method of warfare, and to eradicate their national existence are nothing less than genocidal. These acts constitute war crimes.
Mansour made the comments in a letter to the UN Security Council. On Monday, Israel declared its decision to impose a complete siege on Gaza, cutting off the supply of electricity, food, fuel, and water. The move that could leave the territory on the brink of a new humanitarian crisis has drawn international condemnations. The UN said depriving civilians of goods essential for survival is banned under international law. The European Union also criticized Israel's move as a collective punishment against all Palestinians. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused the U.S. of inflaming West Asia by sending an aircraft carrier group to the region. Putin called the move a mistake that only exacerbates the situation. He also blamed the violence in Palestine on Washington, describing it as a vivid example of the failure of U.S. policy in the region. Washington has announced plans to move a carrier strike group closer to Israel to support the regime. That following a surprise attack on Saturday by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas on Israel. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has warned Washington's move would risk the massacre of Palestinians. Iraqi resistance groups have warned the U.S. against any engagement in the ongoing Israeli war on Gaza. Iraq's Hezbollah brigades, also known as Katib Hezbollah, said that it will hit U.S. bases and Israeli positions if Washington gets involved in the Gaza war. The group added that its forces, drones, and missiles are fully prepared to retaliate. The Al-Nujaba movement issued a similar warning. It promised a decisive military response in case the U.S. or any other country gets involved in the conflict against the Palestinian nation. People in different countries have held new rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people in Gaza and their struggle to free their land. They have chanted slogans in support of the Palestinian cause and denounced the Israeli regime's atrocities. Let's take a listen to those slogans and some of the comments by the protesters.
Palestine! what is right, what actually the Palestinian people are going through, we know, and we have the heart to accept that and to support that. That's why we all support that. A cause that we stand by.
We've come here to express our feelings to save Gaza. We stand with the Muslims of Gaza, and until they're victorious, we will stand with them.
If Israel had complied with the UN resolutions as it should have done and go without punishment before the international community, then this would not have taken place.
I'm here as a Palestinian to support the people from Mideast, both for the people in Israel and Palestine. We are demonstrating here because there won't be any peace while Israel keeps occupying a land that doesn't correspond to it.
I think what the Palestinian resistance did is totally valid and legitimate. It's their right to respond to the attacks of the Israeli state after more than 75 years against the Palestinian people.
Palestinians must have their rights and lands returned to them. They must be compensated. All those who were killed in the past should be compensated according to Islamic Sharia law. We demand an end to the nighttime attacks on Palestine.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyidi Khamenei, has made a speech about the ongoing Palestinian operation against the Israeli regime in Gaza. He has described the operation as a destructive quake, saying that the regime has suffered an irreparable failure. Ayatollah Sayyidi Khamenei said those who attribute the operation to non-Palestinians are making mistakes. The leader underlined that the damage inflicted on Israel and the surprise operation by Palestinians is the result of the regime's own actions. Ayatollah Khamenei said the brave move by Palestinians was a response to years of Israeli crimes. The leader said Israel is now playing the victim card and that Western media outlets are helping the regime in this regard. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the regime cannot be portrayed as an oppressed entity while it is actually a monster. He warned Israel and its backers that the bloodshed of Palestinians will bring them greater calamity. Let's get some analysis on that and more. Ali Mweka is an Islamic scholar and activist who joins us from Nairobi on the phone. And we also have Tyler Popp, who's a geopolitics commentator who joins us from Toronto. Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, if I may, Ali Mweka, and taking a look at the statements made there by Iran's leader. I'd like to highlight the one that he said, basically, that everybody has talked about Israel's a failure, but I am underlining the fact that it's irreparable, the destruction now that Israel is experiencing, in part because of the Operation Al-Aqsa flood. First of all, do you agree with that? Has Israel actually reached that level?
When we look at the situation that currently we are facing in the world, I'm not sure, currently we are facing in the world, and I'm speaking from the perspective that we have currently in Kenya. The past few years we have seen, especially with the opportunities that people these days they have through social media, through internet, and we can see what the Israelis they are doing to the Palestinians. And also this, it was a shock for everyone, not just in Iran or in other places. Even myself, when a friend told me, we were in Tanzania, in East Africa, and a friend told me that some of the guys from Hamas, they infiltrated and they entered a place and also they took control of a town. I told my friend, please confirm the news. This is not it's not possible. This is Israel that we're talking about, a country that... they are known for us in Africa that they are superpower. Maybe it's a small country, but they show themselves as a superpower in Middle East. So I did not believe that, personally speaking. But after following up with the news and the videos that came out, it was a big shock for all of us that Hamas managed to do such a thing, a big operation, without Israel knowing. And it was just something that, as you said, the imparable, to be honest.
Tyler Popp, taking a look at the way that now Israel is bombarding the Gaza Strip and taking away civilian lives and the intentions that it has behind that, the humanitarian aspect has to be highlighted here, but in particular through the lens of how the U.S., for example, is supporting that and Western countries, justifying the fact that Palestinian lives need to be snuffed out. This is very alarming. But at the same time, it shows the true nature of not only Israel, which we've known throughout the years, especially with the wars that it has executed against the Gaza Strip, but also the Americans and other European powers. Isn't that a point that needs to be reflected on here in order to get a complete picture at a minimum?
Yes. For me, when I hear what is going on, you know, specifically the last couple of days have been very hard on the Palestinian citizens. There's been incessant bombing of many buildings, mostly civilian infrastructure. There is attacks upon hospitals, upon the schools, upon you know, the ambulances and firefighters. So they're in no way able to protect themselves. There was a humanitarian corridor that was supposed to have opened up for them to leave towards Egypt. And promptly after that, that humanitarian corridor was bombed by the IDF forces. So for me, it looks very much like this is an attempt at genocide. The excuse from the Israeli forces is that, you know, they're trying to attack Hamas. But, you know, the citizenry of Palestine, they're not Hamas, although the citizens may have some members there who support it. Unfortunately, there is no place for them to go to find safety. So at this point, they cannot leave. They have no water. They have no electricity. Food and medical supplies are being denied entry in. And as the Minister of Defense for Israel has stated, there will be no war crimes trials for their soldiers. They can do what they will without any form of retribution for the people of Palestine.
Go to Beirut to see what's happening there. Our correspondent joins us now. I do apologize for that title, Pop, but Mariam Saleh, our correspondent, joins us from Beirut now to tell us about what's happening where she's at. Mariam, over to you.
Yes, well, as we said earlier, we are in the Burj Barajni Palestinian refugee camp in the outskirts of Beirut. This is one of the biggest camps, actually, in Beirut itself, which holds hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees. You have here the first generation of refugees still alive. You have the second generation, third generation, now even perhaps a fourth generation, and they are all believers of the fact that they will go back to their homeland, they will go back to Palestine. Here, the children, the men, the women, the elderly, all of them saying that what they are seeing in Palestine unfold right now, it's true that there are massacres against the peoples by the Israelis, which is something they have grown used to. This is something they see throughout the decades. They have continued to witness all sorts of crimes against their people. However, the fact that the resistance has become stronger today than ever before and is ready to take the initiative of liberating their land is in itself very significant. So therefore, the mood today was that of a celebratory mood. Everyone was celebrating. They feel that now is the time where they can actually believe in the liberation of Palestine. Now, to join me is political activist Dr. Abdel Malik Sokari. How do you see that today is different than any time in the past when it comes to the true dream of liberating Palestine?
Our people in Gaza Strip are nowadays under a barbaric war, like a genocide declared by the Netanyahu government and American President Joe Biden. So it's our responsibility now is all people, Arab, Muslims, free people in the world, is to stand by Palestinians and to offer all kind of support by media, by demonstrations, to offer money, to offer medicine, to offer everything they can do.
Do you think that now the mood is different, that we are closer to a liberation? As we can see, the children themselves are saying, I want to go back to Palestine, and they're seeing the patience of their fellow citizens inside Palestine.
Palestinian resistance on 7th of October made a very, very brave operation and defeated the Israeli army and liberated some villages, Palestinian villages, occupied by the Israelis since 48, for the first time since 48. And they are so the situation now is much, much better than before. The morale is very high. All people are seeing the going to Palestine and to pray in Al-Quds nearer than ever before.
Thank you very much, Dr. Abdelmalek Soukari. He is an activist, a Lebanese activist, who is always supportive of Palestine. Now, he mentioned two things that are very significant. The fact that this is a war launched by the Israelis with support of the U.S. And speaking of the U.S. support, we have a statement by Hezbollah as resistance. And this is actually a statement by Hezbollah itself that stressed that we were not slightly surprised with the political stances and the procedures taken by the U.S. administration, including the statements I'm reading here, the translation of the statement, that they were not surprised by the stances and procedures taken by the U.S. administration, including the statements made by the U.S. president and his outspoken support and open backing of the Zionist military machine against the Palestinian people, since this is the essence, as they called it, of the U.S. policies and its continuous assistance to the aggression and terror since the establishment of this occupying, usurping entity. Now, the statement continued to say, we consider the United States a full partner in the Zionist aggression, and it holds full responsibility for the killings and crimes and blockade and destruction of homes and the horrific massacres against the unarmed civilians, the children, the women, and the elderly. Also, they said that we call on the populace of our Muslim and Arab nations, which knows the ugly truth of the United States and its aggressions against the people of our nation in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, to denounce the interference of the United States and its regional and international partners, and to expose this interference on all levels.
Mariam, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. According to data from the U.S. National Water Information System, 50% of domestic wells in the United States have detectable concentrations of uranium. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. A new study revealed about 95% of the U.S. population is drinking water from wells and community systems containing unsafe levels of toxic contaminants. Scientists at the University of New Mexico identified at least six pollutants, primarily arsenic, nitrates, uranium, and lead, linked to neurological and developmental problems. Fracking fluids and PFAS was also detected in the drinking water that also flows to the homes of about 320 million Americans. The authors of the report, the six contaminants represent a small fraction of the thousands of chemical agents present in drinking water in the United States. The team also warned that two or more contaminants could be present in a water source, presenting the possibility of synergistic effects. The study published in Nature reads, "The seven contaminants and contaminant groups presented here represent a tiny fraction of the thousands of regulated and unregulated chemical agents present in drinking water." This review illustrates the complexities of the array of chemical hazards in Americans' drinking water and highlights the need for a concerted effort to invest in upgrading their drinking water infrastructure, strengthening drinking water standards, develop and implement enhanced water treatment, and collect and disseminate monitoring data and require more stringent chemical safety testing to support the welfare of all U.S. residents. The team found arsenic is detectable in more than 50% of community water systems, with 2.6% exceeding the maximum contaminant level. These high levels were found in the U.S. Southwest and Great Plains regions, where hard rock mining processes and mine waste occur. Arsenic has long been flowing through drinking water systems, but while the maximum contaminant level is 0.01 micrograms per liter, parts of the United States have seen higher levels of arsenic. The study highlights that from 2009 through to 2011, the average arsenic concentrations were 1.7 micrograms per liter nationwide. The researchers shared the highest were located in communities categorized as semi-urban, Hispanic, and communities in the southwestern United States. Communities with less than 500 residents, communities reliant on groundwater sources, and incarcerated populations in the southwestern United States. Repeated exposure can damage DNA, weaken the immune system, and lead to the formation of cancer cells, as well as high blood pressure and heart disease. Detections of lead stem from America's history of using the material for water system pipes during the 1800s. However, lead pipes continued to be installed in the United States until they were banned in 1986, including in locales such as Chicago, Illinois, that required lead service line installation until then. The Environment Protection Agency, the EPA, does not have a set of maximum contaminant level, or MCM, for lead, but established a treatment technique requiring systems to control the corrosiveness of their water. If more than 10% of the tap water samples exceed the action level of 0.015 milligrams per liter, water systems must take additional steps, part of the lead and copper rule. The study highlights research conducted in 2021 that found 186 million Americans receive water from CWs with detectable lead contamination, and a majority of these people live in minoritized and lower-income communities. Lead is also highly toxic and associated with adverse health endpoints across virtually all body systems, including the nervous system, the cardiovascular system, the renal system, the immunological system, the hematological system, and the reproductive developmental systems in men and women, both in adults and children. Uranium occurs naturally in Earth's crust, which leaches into water systems through geochemical processes. Previous studies have shown that 74% of Americans have traces of the substance in their urine, and in the human body, it accumulates in the bone and the kidneys. Alpha radiation from uranium radioactive decay is classified as carcinogenic, and increasing epidemiological evidence shows that exposure to uranium in its metallic form is associated with chronic kidney failure and kidney disease, and neurologic, reproductive, and cardiovascular toxicity. The website New York Breaking News writes, according to data from the U.S. National Water Information System, 50% of domestic wells in the United States have detectable concentrations of uranium. The study says nitrate levels in water resources have increased worldwide from applications of inorganic fertilizer and animal manure in agricultural areas. The report adds, contamination sources also include septic systems that do not effectively remove nitrogen and discharges from wastewater treatment plants, as well as atmospheric deposition of nitrogen oxides and fertilizer use on lawns, golf courses, and parks. The team found that in 2019, about 5.6 million Americans were exposed to levels over the maximum limit. These levels were primarily detected in the Yakima Valley of Washington State and the San Joaquin Valley of California. Consuming too much nitrate can affect how blood carries oxygen and causes methemoglobinemia, when the hemoglobin can carry oxygen but cannot release it effectively to body tissues. These substances are derived from oil and gas extracted deep underground through wells. There are 150,000 active wells nationwide, and more than 9 million Americans rely on drinking water sources within 1 mile of these sites. Fracking fluids and wastewater from the process can contain toxic, radioactive, and carcinogenic chemicals. And the study notes that up to 4% of spills go unreported. Per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are synthetic chemical compounds used in cleaning products, certain fabrics, non-stick cookware, and other items. According to the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, over 98% of the U.S. population has detectable levels of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances in their blood. According to the authors of the report, the highest levels of PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances in drinking water, have been found close to industrial facilities, where per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are manufactured or processed, and sites with discharges of aqueous film-forming foam, at military bases, at major airports, and other fire training areas. The study shared that up to 80 million Americans get water that is tainted with high concentrations of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. In 2023, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, estimated that from 70 to 94 million people in the United States are exposed to 6 per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances of concern in their drinking water at elevated levels.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As we have been going through the theme of living the pure life, or living the life that Islam has envisioned us to live, we got to a point yesterday where we looked at the topic of community building. We want to move on from that point of last night and go on to our next discussion this evening. If you look at Surah Al-Baqarah, chapter 2, verses 155, 156, and 157, we find the secret of life and the secret of how to deal with challenges that we will come across. What does Allah say in verse 155? Allah says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَلُنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِشَيْءٍ مِّنَ الْخَوْفِ وَالْجُوءِ وَالنَّقْصِ مِّنَ الْأَمْوَالِ وَالْأَنفُسِ وَالثَّمَرَاتِ. He says, most certainly, without a doubt, we will test you. A bala, in this instance of the Quran, it means a test. It means an examination from Allah. We are being put under examination every single moment of our lives, brothers and sisters. You know, some people think that when I become a mu'min, when I say I believe, that things are smooth sailing. You know, that no problems will happen. I'm just running on autopilot. But actually Allah tells us, Surah Al-Ankabut tells us, Allah says that, do you people think that they should be left alone saying, I believe, amanna, wahum la yuftanun, and they would not be tested? So actually the challenges come when you become a Muslim. When you become a believer, that is when the challenges appear in life. Not because God hates us, not because He doesn't want to see us progress and make us, you know, make us or get to a better stage. No, but because through examination we become better people. Why do our children go to school and get examinations? Why do the teachers give them exams? Sometimes you'll walk into class on a Monday morning and they'll say, there's a pop quiz. Right? They'll test them on the spot. Not because the teacher hates the kids. No, he wants to make sure that they know the material, that they have been studying, be doing, you know, their due diligence throughout the academic year, to get them to see how strong they are. The teacher usually knows his or her students. Right? When you're a teacher in madrasa or in a public school like the school that the Al-Mustafa runs, when you're a teacher and you have your students for the first few months, you can kind of gauge who's going to pass with what mark based on their abilities throughout the academic year. So the examination is more for the student to see where they are at so they can grade themselves. You know, Allah tells us in another verse of the Quran, بَلِ الْإِنسَانُ عَلَى نَفْسِهِ بَصِيرًا وَلَوْ أَلْقَى مَعَذِيرًا. Allah says, but the human being, we know ourselves better. We know ourselves better than other people, even though we try to put up excuses, right? So when Allah says, وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِشَيْءٍ مِّنَ الْخَوْفِ, we will test you with something of fear and of hunger and a loss in your life and in your wealth and in the things that mean the most to you. He's saying, I'm going to test you, but I'm testing you because I want to see how committed you are to the cause. How much stamina and spiritual strength do you have to battle the challenges that you will come across? Is your iman simply lip service to God, or does it have a rooting in the heart? And then God says, وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ. When you go through challenges, COVID is, was, will be a challenge. Will we ever get back to whatever normal is? You know, people don't know. But whatever happens, God says, وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ. Give glad tidings to the people of patience, of sabr. And here, keep in mind, brothers and sisters, that sabr, which is normally incorrectly translated as patience, and I say incorrectly because if you look at patience as a word, it's generally a very passive action. Right? You go to the doctor's office, they tell you, take a number, have a seat, and wait your turn. Be patient. You can't really do anything to speed up your appointment with the doctor. But sabr, fortitude in Islam, is where you actually recognize your goal and you work to get to that goal. You don't just give up. You don't just say, well, COVID has struck, Our centers have shut, so I'm just going to sit back and wait until the, you know, the masjid opens up again, and then I will reignite my Islam. No, Allah says you have sabr, you keep working towards the goal. And then He says in the next verse, 156, الَّذِينَ إِذَا أَصَابَتْهُمْ مُصِيبَةٌ قَالُوا إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. We've all memorized that passage, I'm sure. Every time somebody dies, we get a WhatsApp, and that's the very first line of it. Allah says that when a difficulty befalls them, not only death, but COVID hit, we'll lose a job, we'll lose a child, we'll have an accident, something bad will happen in our lives. We're expected to not only say the words, Inna Lillah, that we all are the possession or property of God, and we all go back to Him. But just as with Tawheed that we talked about on the second night, we need to internalize this. We recognize that Allah can do whatever He wants to do. We are the property of God, right? We can't question God. We have no right to say to God, why did you bring about COVID? You know, why did you do this? Why did this natural disaster happen? But the goal is that we recognize that we are His property, that we have come from Him, that He has given us existence, and we have to go back. We have to face difficulties. Our faith has to be tested. And then the third verse is as interesting or as equally relevant to this discussion as the first two, where Allah says, أُولَٰئِكَ عَلَيْهِمْ صَلَوَاتٌ مِّن رَبِّهِمْ وَرَحْمَةٌ وَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُحْتَدُونَ. Allah says that when you go through these adversities in life, and we will all go through them, and we have that sabr, that fortitude, that perseverance, we recognize that we are the property of God and that He will do with us as He pleases, but we have the fortitude to bear the difficulties, to recognize the goal of life and work towards it. He says something very interesting. He says, it is upon these people that God sends His salawat. Now, if you remember your ayat of the Quran, there's one other time in the Quran when Allah sends salawat. And that's in chapter 33, Surah Al-Ahzab, where He says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ وَمَلَائِكَتَهُ يُسَلُّونَ عَلَى النَّبِيِّ. That indeed Allah and His angels send salawat on the Prophet. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا سَلُّوا عَلَيْهِ وَسَلِّمُوا تَسْلِيمًا. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Where God orders us to send salawat on the Prophet. After Allah says He sends salawat on us, He sends His calmness, His tranquility, the rahmah, the mercy of God. At that time, it's on the Prophet He sends it. But here in verse 155, 156, and 157 of Surah Al-Baqarah, Allah says that you and I as believers, we're nowhere close to being at the level of Rasulullah. We're nowhere close to being near the level of spirituality of the Ahlul Bayt or the level of isma, of infallibility and protection they have been given. But yet God says when you work with in this world and you deal with adversity, you are deserving of having the salawat of Allah, the blessings of Allah, the care and love and concern of Allah. Now, as I said, that doesn't mean that you and I won't go through tragedies. We will still face adversity.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Karim Adi عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Afghan families are demanding a transparent and impartial investigation into atrocities and wrongdoings committed by the British Special Air Service, SAS forces, and other Western forces during the military occupation of Afghanistan. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A public inquiry on the extrajudicial killing of 80 innocent civilians in Afghanistan by members of the British military begins its hearing in the United Kingdom. The hearings began in public on Monday, 9th of October, but large sections of the inquiry will be conducted behind closed doors on national security grounds. After years of legal challenges and investigative journalism, the independent inquiry was ordered by Britain's Defence Ministry just last December. It focuses on charges that members of three different Special Air Service or SAS units carried out dozens of extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan between mid-2010 and mid-2013. Judicial review proceedings were brought by the Saifullah and Nurzai families in 2019 and 2020. They say that their family members were killed as a result of a policy of extrajudicial killings that were subsequently covered up by the SAS forces and by the British government. The day after four members of Saifullah family were killed during a night raid on February 16, 2011, a Special Air Service Sergeant, SAS Sergeant Major, had described the episode as the latest massacre in an email revealed during the judicial review, suggesting the episode was not an isolated one. Tessa Gregory from Lee Day, a law firm which is representing families of 29 people who were killed, said, "Our clients hope that the opening of this inquiry marks the end of the wall of silence and obstruction that has confronted them over the last decade." The bereaved families look to the inquiry to fearlessly uncover the truth of the deaths of their loved ones and to ensure that those responsible are held to account. The chair of the inquiry, Charles Haddon Cave, has said the charges were extremely serious. Charles Haddon Cave noted that the inquiry would examine whether there was unlawful activity by British military personnel and whether any extrajudicial killings were covered up by the British government. Mansour Aziz, whose brother and sister-in-law were shot and killed while sleeping by British forces during a night raid on 6 of August 2012, said, "In 2012, our house was raided by foreigners and my brother and sister-in-law were killed and their two children severely injured whilst they were sleeping in their bed." Mansour Aziz added, "We want to know the truth of what happened and why it was our house that was raided. We are asking for the court to listen to these children and to bring justice." The inquiry is expected to run for several months. However, according to the inquiry officials, the judge or its legal staff had no plans to try to visit Afghanistan after the Taliban returned to power following the U.S. chaotic withdrawal from the country in August of 2021. Ian Overton, the executive director for Action on Armed Violence, who has been involved in investigating the charges, said efforts should be made to visit the country, or at least the judge should find more engaged ways of verifying these claims. Ian Overton added, "The inquiry, failing to go to Afghanistan, is like a homicide unit not visiting the murder scene." British occupation forces were among the largest contingents of the US-led NATO military alliance forces that illegally invaded Afghanistan in 2001 to purportedly root out the ruling Taliban government and terrorism across the war-ravaged country. However, after 20 years of military occupation of the country, marked by many reports of war crimes against Afghan civilians led by US forces, acts of terrorism remained prevalent across the country and the Taliban rule was re-established in Kabul. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Afghan families are demanding a transparent and impartial investigation into atrocities and wrongdoings committed by British SAS forces and other Western forces during the military occupation of their country. Families who charge unlawful killings by British Special Forces, SAS, in Afghanistan called for an independent inquiry to provide us with the truth. The inquiry, which began its substantive hearings at the Royal Courts of Justice on Monday, 9th of October, is due to focus on illegal activity by the Special Air Force or SAS forces in the war-torn nation between mid-2010 and mid-2013. The probe will look at charges that numerous killings were carried out, as well as cover-up of illegal activity and inadequate investigations by the Royal Military Police. It was launched in the wake of legal challenges to the British government by Lay Day solicitors on behalf of Saifullah and Nurzai families, as well as a number of significant media investigations. One member of the Afghan family, the Saifullah family, said since a raid by British forces, they're having nightmares and dreams filled with difficulties. Ahead of counsel's opening submissions to the inquiry, they said, "On 16th of February 2011, as a consequence of a night raid on a house by the British forces, my father, Haji Abdul Khaliq, and my two brothers and my cousin were killed." They said, "Before their killings, our family had a very beautiful life. This was a very difficult, saddening and painful night." He added, "Since this raid by the British occupation forces on our house, we have lost our normal sleep and are having nightmares and dreams filled with difficulties." They said, "When this incident took place, we lost everything." They added, "My family and I request the inquiry team to provide us with the truth and explain to us why and on what basis we had to go through this cruelty." The probe is now set to hear submissions on behalf of the families of 33 people, including 8 children, who were killed by SAS forces. Mansour Aziz had called on the inquiry to listen to 2 children who were severely injured by British occupation forces during a night raid on his family home on 6th of August 2012. 2 Royal Military Police investigations, codenamed Operation Northmoor and Operation Sestro, are said to be scrutinised by the inquiry. No charges were brought under Operation Northmoor, a £10 million investigation which was set up in 2014 to examine charges of executions by SAS forces, including those of children. Operation Sestro saw 3 soldiers referred to the service prosecuting authority, but none were prosecuted. Lee Day partner Tessa Gregory said, The bereaved families look to the inquiry to fearlessly uncover the truth of the deaths of their loved ones and to ensure that those responsible are held to account. She added, proper accountability must involve those at a senior level in the armed forces and in government who are responsible for the mismanagement and oversight of our so-called most elite forces. The independent statutory inquiry was commissioned by then Defence Secretary Ben Wallace under the 2005 Inquiries Act. A Ministry of Defence MOD spokesman claimed, "The Ministry of Defence is fully committed to supporting the inquiry as it continues its work. It is not appropriate for us to comment on charges which may be within the scope of their statutory inquiry, and it is up to the statutory inquiry team led by Lord Justice Haddon Cave to determine which charges are investigated."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. This meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. What I would like to say is that the event of the Sacred Defense is a prominent, important period in our country's history. As to what was being defended, the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Republic, which was the product of defending the Islamic Revolution, and the country's territorial integrity were being defended. These were the three important things that were being defended. The other side had attacked these three things. Of course, the target of the main important part of the front of the enemy, which I will explain later in the second part of my speech, was not of the issue of territorial integrity. That was Saddam's goal. Their target was the revolution. They wanted to suppress this unparalleled, great, important revolution that had taken place in Iran thanks to the sacrifices that had been made by the people.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Why do we say it was unparalleled? Because it was a phenomenon that had not taken place before in major revolutions. It was democratic, it was religious, it was authentic, and it was not dependent. It was related to a nation, it was by the people. It was not like coups, revolutions by political parties, or things of that sort. This revolution was able to remove the dependent corrupt system that was ruling the country and establish a new system and a new voice in its place, the Islamic Republic. Republic means democracy. Islamic means religion. Religious democracy was a new term in the world. We have had religious governments throughout history, but there was no talk of democracy in them. We have had democratic governments, real or fictitious, but there was no talk of religion in them. Never before had there been a government or a system in which religion and this world and the hereafter, the people and God were all involved and were the builders of it. But such a thing happened and they wanted to crush it, overcome it, and eliminate the Islamic Republic.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.